Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Randy.
What part of the states are you from?
I grew up in upstate New York in Schenectady, which is just outside Albany, New York, about 3 hours north of New York City, about 3 hours south of Montreal, in fact.
I understand that you come from a musical family?
Yes. My father plays the piano, and his sister, Peggy, is also a pianist. And she was, in fact, my first music teacher. And her husband, Bill, is a bass player. And so through them, I've always had music constantly around me. My parents met in a club and my father was playing, actually. Yeah.
So what kind of music did you listen to growing up?
My parents were into jazz. My dad kind of turned my mother onto jazz. She wasn't really into it in the beginning. He was very into Bill Evans, and she eventually became a huge fan of jazz and Bill Evans in particular. And my aunt and uncle were also jazz. They are jazz musicians, but they were listening more to fusion, like at the time in the 70s and stuff. I remember hearing a lot of Chick Corea, and they gave me Jaco Pastorius' first record. I remember when I was 16. Because I was just starting the bass, and
that's a good start.
Yeah, it was a very, very nice thing to come in touch with. But they weren't that into, I would say, like straight ahead jazz. Like, I got more in touch with that once I got into school, and you know, I mean, like Bird and Coltrane and that. But my parents were really into good music. I have to say, they were into aside from jazz, they liked Blood, Sweat, and Tears. They liked Chicago, Stevie Wonder. It was always like really rhythmic, kind of, I don't know how to say it, just it wasn't pop music, in other words. They were into more, adventurous. If it was pop, it was more adventurous pop, I'll put it that way.
So what lasting influence did your family have on you growing up?
Like I said, my dad playing the piano, he was in a band that would sometimes rehearse at our house when I was a real small kid, and I can remember, just basically seeing the drums and kind of being obsessed and always wanting to play the drums. And, I mean, what I'm trying to say is music was always there, basically. And through that experience with my father and then with my aunt and uncle, they met at school, in fact, in a music theory class up in Plattsburgh. And, but what I would say is they always, especially Peggy and Bill, my aunt and uncle, They always shared music, like with each other and with all their friends. They were very close with Nick Brignole, you know, the Barry player that passed away a couple years ago.
For sure, yeah.
Yeah, they have like a really extensive network of musician friends upstate. Whenever I go there, I'm always meeting more and more people that are their friends. But they're all players, so music always had a very like kind of positive thing in my life. You know, it wasn't. Let me put it this way. When I went to school, when I went to Juilliard especially, I knew a lot of great players that grew up playing, you know, violin or cello or whatever. Mm. But a lot of it was through their parents' kind of insistence. And they didn't necessarily have a great relationship with music as a result. It was more something they were forced to do. And my parents, my father, though he did insist I try to, you know, he tried to make me practice each day, whatever, you know, if I was studying piano with my aunt or the drums when I was a kid, up until I was in college. I was a drummer, I think I told you that before. But anyway, it was never, like, dogmatic. It was more for discipline. And music, it always kind of remained something that I chose to do as a result.
Do you remember the first concert that you ever attended?
Seeing Buddy Rich. My father took me to see Buddy Rich's big band. It's my first memory. I'm not sure if it's the first one, but I do remember seeing them. And I can also remember him taking me to see Count Basie's band. Hmm. But I'm not sure how old I was, probably 10.
That must have left a lasting impression on you.
Oh, yeah, no. Especially Buddy Rich.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say that. I mean, I've seen Buddy several times, and every time I've seen him was an event.
Yeah, it was amazing. I was totally into him at the time, you know. And I also had these friends up the street. I should mention this. They were three brothers, and they all played music. The parents were from Italy. I would go there, and it was like a very interesting environment because his parents didn't really speak English, and they would be making wine in this one part of their basement. In the other part of the basement, they had like incredible instruments, drums, an amazing stereo, and these guys were really into similar music that I was into, and a lot of the horn bands from the 70s, like Chicago and Bill Chase Band, and but they had a really strong influence on me because it was always just about music. I would go there, and there was always music around. And in fact, I hadn't seen him in a long time until a few months ago when I played in Schenectady with my band. I ran into all of them, and it was kind of nice because like they had such a huge influence on me in those, you know, teenage years, I would say.
So in other words, you had a really rich upbringing when it comes to music.
Yeah, I did. I was lucky in that sense. I mean, I wasn't around classical music like when I went to conservatory, I realized there were serious gaps in what I was exposed to. I had to really catch up. Partly it was because of the bass. I hadn't played the upright bass until I was in college. So there was the, you know, technical, physical challenge of just learning the instrument, but also just the music itself, you know, just the symphonic repertoire, and it's a different sensibility. It's a different music, I would say, even, obviously, but I would say, yes, it was very rich. It was just in another form of music, and that's probably why I always wanted to really play jazz, because that's where I came from, in a sense.
Now, speaking of the bass, do you spend a lot of time practicing?
In theory, probably not as much as I used to. I'm able to practice more focused, but I have to say, it's one of the hardest things for me is to really practice efficiently. It's, you know, the better I get at it, the older I get, the better I get at it, but it's something I really struggle with. But I would say, in the last few years, I feel like I can really get a lot done in a short amount of time. But, you know, if I'm not practicing, it's bothering me that I'm not practicing. It's constantly a struggle. I mean, I think a lot of musicians would say the same.
How many basses do you have?
Well, I have 4 acoustic basses. In fact, I'm selling one if you're interested. I have 3 basses that I play primarily. I have a really nice Italian bass that I met a guy here in New York from Italy, and he was selling the bass, and I eventually went over and tried it out and bought it and had some work done, and it turned out to be an incredible find. That's my main instrument. I have that set up for jazz right now, so I can't play like any classical gigs on that. So for those types of gigs, I have an old 200-year-old German bass that is absolutely huge and very impractical in terms of taking it around subways in New York City, but you know, it's a great, great old sound, and it's a very special bass. And then I have a plywood bass, a K bass, that I basically, it's like my work instrument. Like in a little while, I have to go to play a little Latin gig, and that's a perfect bass because it sounds very, very good, and it's not as valuable in terms of like being in a place that maybe it's going to get knocked around a little bit.
Is that the bass that folds up?
No, it's just a plywood bass. It's actually from the 50s.
Oh, okay.
K was a company that made basses here in the States. A lot of guys have them. They're one of the better plywood basses. They sound great. You put a bow on it, may not be the best sound, but they're really amazing basses. So it's a very practical instrument to have for just work.
Do you have any electric basses?
Oh, yeah, I do. I started on electric bass, in fact. I have my original bass, which is a Fender Jazz. I think it's a 75, and I bought that from my mother's sister, who was just playing around with rock and roll and wanted to learn the bass.
All in the family, right?
Yeah, but my mother's side, which wasn't necessarily as musical as my father's, and she's not even a musician, my aunt, my mother's sister, but and I do have a Music Man, which is an electric bass designed by Leo Fender, the guy that obviously from Fender, the Fender company, which I bought a few years ago because I needed a 5-string. And so I play sometimes, not quite as much as I'd like, but I do get a chance to, you know, definitely keep it up.
Do you ever have time to do any teaching?
I taught a lot when I lived in Europe, and here I'll teach occasionally. Somebody will maybe call me up and want a lesson here and there. It's not something I do regularly, though I certainly would like to hook something up. I mean, I have enough, I think, schooling where I could maybe offer something to somebody, and it would be nice to have something secure, we'll put it that way, you know, just for benefits and whatnot. But it's very hard to hook up, you know, other than an adjunct position, it's very hard to get those here in the city. Cause there's so many great musicians that are in the same situation as me, you know. I'd like to do more, though, I would say, for sure.
So when you're performing, is there a particular setting that you feel more comfortable playing in? For example, solo, duo, big band, whatever?
Not necessarily. I mean, I feel pretty comfortable, I mean, in all the things you mentioned, but I would say I prefer to... It's the musicians around me that, if I had to choose, rather than choosing an ensemble, it would be the musicians that I would have in the group, meaning just them being more, like, open-minded, you know, and because there are a lot of great musicians in New York, but a lot of them are really fixed on particular style, like bebop guys or Latin players, and they're not always into sort of mixing it up. I'm not sure if that makes any sense, but the guys that I've been playing with in my group, a lot of the reason I like to play with them is simply because they're just very, very open-minded, huge ears, and the music goes wherever it goes. And that's the thing. I mean, if you're going to play jazz, why rehearse it to the point where you're just going to recreate the rehearsal, let the music go where it's going to go? And if you have six musicians that are all very confident and very musical and very open, music, who knows where it's going to go?
Yeah, you know, exactly. Yeah. If you had an opportunity to form a dream band, who would it consist of?
That's hard to say. I mean, I kind of think I have a sort of a dream band now. I'm always discovering, like, I've been using this piano player in the last year, Luis Perdomo, and I have to say, I couldn't think of anybody I'd rather have in the band than him. He comes from Venezuela, and he's got a real Latin rhythmic background, obviously, but he has huge ears, and his sensibility for jazz, straight-ahead jazz, is incredible. I mean, I couldn't replace him, and I don't know. That's a really tough question.
That would certainly add to the overall sound of your band as well when you have musicians of that caliber.
Well, sure.
I mean, with you.
And in New York, you know, there's just so many great players. That's one of the reasons we stay here.
Now, you said earlier that you started off playing drums. Now, after all these years, do you still tap the skins from time to time?
You know, I got a drum set recently, and I have them set up sometimes in my house. I can't leave them set up because there's not enough space. But not really. To be honest, I'm trying to be more focused, and if I'm going to practice, I'll try to practice the bass, or if I'm going to write, let's go to the piano. And I mean, I'm very easily distracted, and for a long time I was trying to do too many things, but I do enjoy them. I have to say, when I'm able to sit down and, you know, if there's no drummer around, I'll maybe have a little more courage, but, you know, or it's something that you kind of want to do in the privacy of your own home, nobody around.
Getting back to your family, it must have been
sure.
A real learning experience for you, witnessing and taking part in jam sessions at such an early age.
Yeah, I mean, I was very lucky for that. I can remember my father teaching me and my brother both, I think it was like All the Things You Are, you know, just standards,
yeah.
And playing his Rhodes, and me playing the drums, and my brother playing electric bass, and, you know, just sort of, and then switching. He started to play the drums, and I started to play the bass. But anyway, just sort of, you know, learning to think about chords and all that stuff. Yeah, I was lucky for that, I have to admit. And my aunt, Peggy, she was my first music teacher, like I said, on piano, but she insisted I take, she would bring me theory homework each week, and that was an amazingly valuable thing, because like a lot of kids in conservatory, they had great ears at perfect pitch, but didn't necessarily have a background in harmony and theory, and I had all that, you know, and that's what jazz musicians need. You know, so I was lucky. My father and my aunt really shaped me well in that sense.
What first attracted you to the bass and to the drums?
Well, the drums, I can't really say. It was just sort of like I was so young, I can't even remember not liking the drums. I just just remember begging my father to let me play the drums from my earliest memories, and he, like I said, made me play the piano first. But I think rhythm, I always liked rhythm. There's something about it, I felt like it kind of came naturally. And then with the bass, my brother had the instrument, an electric bass, but I had a little easier time understanding how it worked because of piano and all the theory I was doing with my aunt. And I would sometimes find myself telling him, you know, what to do, and there was, you know, sibling rivalry there and all. But, and he was actually a really good drummer, and it kind of worked out. And then I got to a point, I think around 17, when I started to think about playing the double bass. Even though our school didn't have any string program, I was just realizing I was going to be too old to play the piano. You know, I really wanted to go to conservatory. I wanted to have that background, that training. I'm not sure why, it's just I kind of felt like I needed that to fall back on, or validation or something. And the drums, I wasn't really wanting to be a percussionist. I didn't want to carry all those instruments around. I didn't want to play, you know, Beethoven symphonies and just have like two notes to hit or whatever it was. And I also thought, like, jazz, I ultimately wanted to really be a jazz player. And with the bass, you can experience all different kinds of music. Bass is everywhere. So, as a result of not being focused, I just kind of kept my options open. And with the bass, my options were probably, you know, just more. There were just more options, like I said, because of the instrument itself. And it also, it was a combination of knowing rhythm and knowing harmony, melody, whatever. Bass is, you know, you're a rhythmic player, your rhythmic function, as well as a harmonic function. And the drums and the piano, kind of, it's in some sense a combination of the two, if you know what I mean.
You studied with Richard L. Bagley. What was that experience like for you?
Well, that was probably a very, that was probably the turning point in my education, because basically, like I was saying, in my senior year of high school, I, you know, just trying to figure out what I was going to do. My teacher at my elementary school, actually I went to the same school for 13 years, he was my teacher my whole life, Mr. Patrick, he recommended I get in touch with this percussionist that he played in the Albany Symphony with to take lessons, and I did. And he accepted me into the school eventually, because it was too late for me to apply to all the other schools I had waited, and all the other schools that I thought to go to, like Potsdam, up in your neck of the woods, in fact. They had already filled all of their, you know, the roster, so to speak. So I was going to be waitlisted no matter where I went. So I went to Albany State, and Richard L. Bagley said, you come here, even though I know you want to play the bass, that's fine. Just play in the percussion ensemble, and if they accept you as a bass major eventually, then it works out for you. But if not, you can always have a percussion thing to fall back on. So he was amazing. The guy is legendary. He has students, I know in the Met, I think the principal percussionist, or the timpanist, one of them, I can't remember which, is an Al Bagley student. He taught Stefan Harris, you know, the vibes player, I'm
yes.
sure.
Mm-hmm.
And, God, I'm constantly meeting people that he's taught, and just an amazingly dedicated teacher and beautiful guy. I haven't seen him in years. I tried to get a hold of him, but he really helped me out.
Eastman and Juilliard must have been major turning points for you as well.
Yeah, Eastman was probably the biggest one, I would say, because I got there and I was 20, and I had, like I said, very little experience playing what I now realize is real jazz. And there were a lot of opportunities there. Very few bass players, and you know, I just had a lot of chances to play. And the faculty was great. Bill Dobbins was very into Duke Ellington. The writing, as well as you know, just studying everything about Duke, but he really ingrained that into us. And I mean, as a result, I learned a lot about Duke, and that music is probably the most special to me still, you know, just and to my heart, as well as just to what his music is in general. I mean, it was really amazing. I was very lucky to have come across that, in other words, and Bill was insistent with it. And then there was also Ray Wright, who was an arranging teacher, who passed away shortly after I left. But there were just a lot of opportunities to do different things there, you know, like the writing, you could write and get your stuff played. Studio orchestra, for example, was like a big band combined with an orchestra, and you had to write to have your piece played. And, you know, it was a real serious challenge. But and the attitude of the students at the time, you know, because everybody had to be a classical major, even though they were more interested in jazz. So, you know, we were all kind of sharing, like, these dual roles, if that makes any sense.
That's basically people the fundamentals, right?
I think so. I mean, if you ask me, do I believe in studying or you know, offering jazz in colleges, universities, I'm not so... I mean, you can learn how to do it, but in terms of really learning jazz and shaping yourself as an artist, school isn't really the place that it was done. I mean, think about the guys that created the music. They didn't learn it in school. But these days, it's one of the only ways you can really come in touch with the music.
You just have to go back to Miles Davis's bands and Art Blakey's band.
Oh, yeah, sure.
You know, those were schools in and of themselves.
Well, I mean, that's how all those guys learned. They learned it in the streets, you know? I mean, it's like folk music, and when you start putting it into this academic thing, it takes on a different role. And in some ways, that's why I think jazz kind of suffers to a degree in terms of popularity, because we're often playing for our peers, you know? You're thinking constantly about impressing guys or musicians that are listening to you, rather than really making the music that maybe speaks to the general audience.
When it comes to the bass, who have been some of your major influences?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I love Sam Jones. I love Mingus. I mean, they're all for different reasons, of course, you know.
I'm going to throw a name at you that I think has influenced you.
Okay.
And that's Kachow.
Yeah, Kachow, for sure. I mean, if you play bass and if you play Latin music, he's the guy. I mean,
the first time I heard your playing, that's the first person I thought of.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, I thought Kachow.
No,
yeah.
he's the guy. I mean, he's one of my favorites. And I saw him recently. It was his 87th birthday, and it was amazing because the guy playing like a rented instrument. It wasn't very good, and he was playing a bow that he plays a French bow style, which is like a violin or cello, but he was holding a German bow. It was fiberglass, and it was just an incredibly weird situation. The place, there was nobody in the audience. It could have seated 1,500 people. There were maybe 100 people there. And he played great, swinging and musical and beautiful. 87 years old, I mean, inspiring beyond belief.
Well, you know, speaking of 87, we have a very famous musician who just turned 80, and I imagine you know who that is, Tony Bennett.
Oh, yeah, I know. A good friend of mine played that birthday party last Thursday. Joe Cohn, guitar player.
Yes.
Oh, it's great.
You know, it's funny when you talk about musicians who are in their 80s. This past summer, I had a chance to catch Yusef Lateef.
Wow.
And he just blew away everyone. It was absolutely incredible watching
these guys. Some of these guys, you know, like Frank West, too. Just an amazing sort of guy just to be that dedicated. You know, he's on my record. He plays that one tune. And we were doing these... Steady Saturdays at a club near Carnegie Hall. It wasn't even a club, it was a restaurant. And not a great venue, in other words, there wasn't like a real listening room. It was background music to a degree, but I'd get there and he would be in the kitchen warming up with his flute and his tenor. I mean, like well before any of us were there. And, you know, he's just one of these guys that has been around for years. After he left Basie's band in the 60s, he became one of the busiest freelance musicians in New York, doing all kinds of like commercial stuff. So in other words, he's pretty well off. He doesn't need to be doing, you know, these light-paying jazz gigs when it's not even really focusing on him as an art, you know, as the band leader. But he was so dedicated and musical. Played one or two choruses, wouldn't play tons of notes, and just kind of, you know, he was just so incredibly musical, and you could really hear the wisdom. You know, the connection to the tradition that you don't always hear with younger guys, you know. I mean, it was just I was lucky to get him on my record, too.
You mentioned someone earlier who was an influence on you, and that's Sam Jones. Now, that's someone who I think has been long underrated out there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just for his beat.
That's
time,
right.
You know, and then as a bass player, I mean, that's what I think about. I would like to think most bass players think about. Not so much about the soloing, it's just about the feel. And man, that feel is just insane for me. I mean, it's just very, very special.
Now, you were in Barcelona and Paris for a while. Now, how did all that come about?
Well, Barcelona came up. I just got out of school. I was kind of in New York floating around trying to, you know, do whatever, playing a jazz gig and practicing orchestra excerpts, thinking I would try to get a job. And the conductor of that orchestra came to New York to hire, I think he needed 9 players, 3 basses and a few others. And I didn't really have a lot of time to prepare, so that was probably the reason. But I landed the gig, I won the audition, and it was for principal bass. And I was hesitant about going, because I felt like now that I'm out of school, I want to be in New York and get everything going. But it was supposed to be just for 1 year, and it was during the Olympics back in 92, a long time ago now. And I thought, okay, you know, and the money was decent, and I could pay off my bass. And once I got there, I just was like, I'm never going back to New York, because it was, you know, it was such a beautiful, beautiful place. We played in this amazing hall, and I was learning Spanish, just living, you know, being enriched in ways that we just don't hear, that we can in New York, you know. And I stayed for 2 years, in fact, and then started to feel like I needed to get back to jazz. And like I said, I didn't want to come back to the States. I didn't miss anything about it, other than my family. I just was never coming back. I thought Rome, Paris, London, but I had some friends in Paris. I went there, and it was okay. Just musically, it wasn't nearly as challenging as I needed it to be. So I thought, well, I could go back to New York and, you know, maybe work even less, because I wasn't working that much in Paris. But more than that, it was just the music wasn't inspiring, you know. Just there was no connection to the real jazz or jazz tradition that, you know, that New York has. And just, that's the problem. You live in New York for a minute, and it's kind of a curse. You can never live anywhere else. If you're a player, if you're a musician, you know, you realize as hard as it is to be here and survive and keep your spirits up, it's unique. It's so special for us, for musicians, you know.
What was it like working with Jean Toussaint?
Well, we did a couple tours. It was good, man, you know, like, because he was from here, so I could really, you know, just relate to his style and everything. It kind of made me homesick to a degree, but we were playing with some European guys too, you know, and so it was a bridge between the two sort of worlds, you know, because it is different. I hate to put it that way, but there's definitely a difference from the music that you hear there and the music that you hear in New York or in the States or, I don't know, North America, I would say.
Here's another tough question for you. What are your 10 favorite recordings of all time?
Yeah, man, that's a cruel question to ask.
And it doesn't have to be jazz.
Coltrane's Crescent Record. Crescent, I love that. Love Supreme. Duke Ellington, Black, Brown, and Beige. And Ornette, Shape of Jazz to Come. My Funny Valentine by Miles and Nefertiti. And I love this particular recording of Bach's Cello Suites by Honor Bilsma. He's like a Baroque cellist from Holland who did a really important recording in the 60s, but he did another recording in the early 90s that not quite as early music-ish, but anyway, it's amazing. He's playing on gut strings and a Stradivarius cello from the Smithsonian. And you know the La Boheme recording with Pavarotti from,
yes,
like the early 70s?
Mm-hmm.
Oh man, that's just amazing. Ahmad Jamal, record of Awakening. Blakey, Art Blakey, I don't know, Ugetsu, there's so many of those. And of course, Bird, the South of the Border, you know, Machito, all that stuff. I mean, there's too many. I can list. They're all precious. I would hate to have to choose, you know, or exclude, I should say.
We recently lost two of the finest percussionists in music. What was it like working with Ray Barretto?
Well, that was really great. I mean, first of all, Ray, just the guy was like a little kid when it came to music. In fact, that's all he really cared about. He was only concerned with music. You know, it was knowing that he had that history of all those people he played with before he became like a salsa guy, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, all those records he made. You know, it's great to have somebody around that you know has been through that, you know. He knew Bird. And he, just a great guy, you know, and a good band leader. He gave me some very good advice the day that we recorded. You know, I was asking him, like, you know, about sort of self-producing and all, you know, and he said, don't trust anybody but your own, but yourself, but your own ears. And that was great advice, because in the end, that's exactly what I did. I found myself thinking of him saying that to me on many occasions, you know, not really yielding to anybody else's advice in the end.
The other great percussionist that we lost was Don Elias. Now, did you ever have a chance to play with him at all?
I never did, no. I mean, I just remember listening to a lot of his recordings. Like I said, with that Jocko record, who's on the first track, Donnelly, and also, oh God, the Joni Mitchell stuff with Shadows and Light, that live record he's playing,
that was
drums,
amazing.
Drum set. Yeah, God, yeah, I love that stuff. You know.
Now, Cuba's left a huge and lasting impression on you. What do you feel is the biggest contribution that this country has made when it comes to music?
When I went there, I was listening to Cuban music. I wasn't really versed in playing it that much. In New York, trying to learn it, you know, you have to try to hook up with the guys that know that music. It wasn't that easy, I have to say. I'm not Latino, so you don't always feel like you have that connection. And when I went to Cuba, you know, they were just, it was so open, the people were so beautiful, and the music is everywhere. You go there, and that's like one of the things that keeps them going. You know, they're in a tough situation, but music is just everywhere. They eat, drink it, breathe it.
What were your first impressions of Cuba?
Well, the first thing that happened when I got there is I lost my passport, so my first impressions maybe like were a little bit hidden at the time. You fly over the Keys, and in 15 minutes you're landing, and you've gone to a completely other planet. It smells different, it looks different, it, you know, of course the cars, I mean, you just realize how far away it is, while at the same time it's so close to you. And then musically, it's so inspired. And like in New York, yeah, I keep telling you how inspired it is, which it is, but that was a whole other thing. I just felt like it electrified me. And it wasn't even about playing Latin music. It was just about music in general. I came back and I just was feeling alive. You know, everything that they played was just so alive, if that makes any sense, you know. And
what exactly is changui?
Changui is music from Guantanamo, the east of Cuba, Oriente. They had a lot of different music in that area. But this particular music is, the instrumentation, first of all, you mentioned about the bass. They don't use the bass, actually. They use a giant, like, thumb piano. It's called marimbula, or like a giant kalimba, you know? You know what that is, right? The box with the metal bars.
Mm-hmm.
But the guy sits on it, and he has these bars that he plays with his hands. And so that takes the bass role. There's no congas. There's bongo, which are tuned very low. And there's tres, which is like a guitar instrument, and then there's maracas, and they sing. It's very syncopated. It's you can hear that it's Cuban maybe, but it's also very unique just because the instrumentation, and it's very, like, a lot of space, and it's incredibly rhythmic and like I said, syncopated. So it's swinging. It's totally amazing.
Are there any challenges that you have to come up against when you're playing in an orchestral setting?
Oh, yeah, sure, there's lots. The thing is, playing other music, like the music we're talking about now, Latin and jazz, I guess, going to an orchestra setting, you have different things that are required of you. So sometimes it's challenging just to change my sort of overall approach. You know, you're listening to your colleague, the bass player next to me, trying to play in tune, trying to deal with the rhythm not being, like, steady, or just not being where you think it's supposed to be. You have to be very sort of accommodating to, you know, where the rhythm goes. It's not straight rhythm like another music. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, definitely.
I don't know. And it's funny, last night I was playing some stuff for a friend, Shostakovich. One of the challenges is this music is so heavy emotionally that you have to really discipline yourself not to get so involved that you're not playing well, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
It's a different discipline, but I've been doing it long enough now, like, to different musics, that I feel like I'm just playing music. It's no longer a huge switch to jump from one to the other. But there are certain things I have to always keep in mind.
I'm going to throw five musicians your way, and I just want you to tell me the first thing that comes to mind when I mention them. Ray Brown.
He's like the seminal bass player, just in terms of his beat. I mean, some guys think it's a little edgy. I love his time feel. It's so earthy, and his sound. And he's, you know, he switched to steel strings. Those guys all came up playing gut strings, and sometimes when they started plugging into amps and started playing on steel strings, it lost that quality, but he never did. I mean, I heard him on the, you know, worst of setups, let me put it that way, and it was just always so earthy, like it always had been back in the day, like I said, with the gut string and that different setup. Just, I mean, God, amazing musician.
Now here's someone who's performed on so many recordings, Ron Carter.
You know, completely different from Ray, but one of the most musical bass players ever, I think. You know, he's got like a radar. When you hear those recordings with Miles and stuff, it's just the music, the interaction between the musicians, you know, it's just a really special player. And he's also one of the other guys that I really like the way he sounds through an amp. In fact, I think I like him better through an amp. That's part of his sound, in other words, the way he gets the sound with his amplifier. You know, not a sound, not a setup that I would use, like a very different kind of string and all that. But man, you know, he just has it all figured out.
And what about Dizzy Gillespie?
Well, Dizzy, I mean, with myself liking Latin jazz so much, I mean, he's one of the guys that you have to, you know, give respect to. And at the same time, you know, he had that obvious thing for entertaining an audience, but the music never was cheapened. Even though he was able to play with them and make jokes and whatnot, the music never, like, suffered.
What about pianist Michel Camilo?
Wow. Phenomenal technique. Guy can play any tempo. It's just amazing how much music he can make at that speed. Very special player.
And one of the most influential musicians of the last, I would say, 50 years, Chick Corea.
Oh, I agree with you, man. You know, I always liked Chick because he had that Spanish sound in his music, you know, back, Now He Sings, Now He Sobs. You could always hear that sensibility, but he still never abandoned, like, the traditional thing, you know. And he always had his own voice. I mean, just a really, really unique, great musician.
What is the most important advice that you would give to up-and-coming musicians?
I would say, like, in terms of writing, try not to be too intellectual, you know. Maybe don't always think of your music as having to impress other musicians. I mean, because that's something we all go through. You know, you're just trying to show these guys something that you can do and that they're going to respect, but you can also get too caught up in that and maybe, like I said before, abandon the audience. You know, you want to make music that people will like. I mean, that's what I think. For me, I can't say everybody is coming from the same place, but you know, that's my interest, and I think we get really caught up in just trying to impress people and musicians and try to out-hip each other or whatever, and I don't know, I just don't be afraid to make beautiful music. I mean, it maybe sounds very, very narrow, very cliche, but, you know, if it's beautiful, sometimes you think it's sentimental, so you may maybe choose to do something else. But just make sure you love what you're playing, what you're writing. I mean, I can say it that way.
Late August is a powerhouse for recording, in that there's this pervading Latin influence throughout, which really serves your playing well. How long did it take for you to record this album?
We did that, well, the sextet things, there are six tunes of the sextet, we did in 2 days. We did another day a few months later, as I was trying to figure out how I was going to complete the record. That was with the Frank West track, and I did that bass and conga duo on there, and I did that Arco thing as well. So 3 days, but, you know, there's a lot of days of mixing and, you know, a few editing things we had to do and whatnot, but basically 3 days.
What's your favorite selection off this album?
I would say the fact that I have Ray Barreto on that first track makes me feel good, because that was like an afterthought. You know, I didn't really plan to have congas on that, but the fact that I got him playing, and now that he's gone, I'm I enjoy it when that comes up. If it ever comes up on my iPod, like with the shuffle, I never put it on, but you know what I'm saying.
You know, my first impression when I heard that album was that you take great joy in playing against the various polyrhythms and Latin flavors.
Well, it's something I'm trying to incorporate more and more. You know, a lot of guys I like in New York, Miguel Zanon and Lisvani Terry, you know, a lot of Latin players, they're really great with rhythm. And I've always liked rhythm, like I said. I still want to get a little bit better at it. But, rhythm, for me, really the primary component if you're going to be playing this music, I think, jazz or, you know, rhythmic music, jazz or Latin music. Try to always think about.
Another impression I got listening to your album was the quality of the compositions. Do you enjoy writing?
Absolutely. I love writing. It's something I've always wanted to do, and it's not something that comes easily. I need a lot of time to sort of let things sit and hear them the next day and decide if I still like them. And, you know, it's the ultimate challenge, really, I think. I mean, improvising on a bandstand is like composing in a way. But having played a lot of classical music, I think that's part of the reason like I like to compose, because I have these sonorities that I've been exposed to, and I just kind of want to play around with them, if that makes any sense.
How long did it take you to write the material for Late August?
Some of the stuff I had written earlier, some of the things came out pretty quickly, like towards the end, like the Frank West thing. I finished actually in the morning of the gig. Of the recording date, that I was kind of just cram it, get it done. Some of the other things I really can't say overall. You know, I would say I had some of the music overall maybe 6 months just working on some things, and then the other things being finished 6 months later.
When it comes to writing, who have been some of your influences?
Well, Duke Ellington. You know, when you think about Mingus, I really think a lot about Ahmad Jamal. Even though he doesn't have big groups like his other guys, he's such an orchestrator with his band, the way they play, you know, and the way he uses vamps and the dynamics. I mean, he's one of the biggest influences on me, and I love, like I said, the classical composers like Shostakovich, like I mentioned before, and Prokofiev, Stravinsky. I love Ravel. I mean, I like too much, I have to be honest. It's too heavy to try to filter through sometimes.
Are there any bass players that you'd love to perform with?
I'd like to play with John Patitucci. I took a lesson with him last year, and, you know, at the end we were, like, kind of playing duo together. And he's one of the best bass players I know. He's great with the bow. Plays on a friend's recording. A Canadian guy, actually, from Ottawa. He plays in the Met. They play Bottasini duo, and John plays great on that, but he's just a monster musician bass player. So I'd call him in a minute if I could do something like that duo kind of thing, you know.
From Ottawa, do you mean John Gege or?
No, his name is Jeremy McCoy.
Oh, Jeremy McCoy, okay.
Yeah.
What's on tap for you for the rest of 2006, projects and recordings and?
Well, I'm trying to get to the studio in the next month to do another record. With a similar setup, sextet, but there'll be hopefully a few surprises. But, you know, along the same lines.
Do you ever listen to a lot of Cuban recordings by, let's say, Mario Baza and other Latin band leaders to get ideas for writing? And
not consciously. I mean, I love Chico Farrell's music, and actually I've been playing that gig the last month. It's been great. Like, I know that music pretty well, but I wouldn't say I turned it on and trying to get ideas. It's just, you know, I don't ever really do that. You just try to listen to what you like, and hopefully it'll come through. But I love that old stuff, Machito and Mario Bauza, all those records. It's definitely some of my favorite music.
Who are the Bang on a Can All-Stars?
Well, Bang on a Can is an organization, like a new music experimental group here in New York, and the All-Stars is like their band. The Bang on a Can, basically they're formed by three composers, Julia Wolf, Michael Gordon, and David Lang, and they needed a band to perform their music, so they put a band together. They put a band together, and they called it the Bang on a Can All Stars. And they play with a lot of amplification. The instrumentation is bass, cello, piano, clarinet, electric guitar, and percussion, and they get all—they're into all kinds of stuff. It's not a jazz group per se, but they do have a lot of connections with like with Ornette. In fact, I played with Ornette with them, and that was amazing. So they're very, very open-minded, and they improvise, and I get to play with them whenever their bass player isn't able to do it. So it's very, very inspiring thing. That's where I was actually last month for 3 weeks, is teaching up at their school in Massachusetts.
So living in New York, do you find that you get much work?
Yes, I mean, I work pretty steadily as a result of, you know, juggling the different styles. I don't have a day gig, so I'm pretty lucky for that, you know. But
New York City itself must have an influence on you in that the city is so culturally rich and it's bound to wear off on you. What does New York City mean to you?
Well, if it weren't for New York, I probably wouldn't be living in the United States. I really liked Europe on many levels. Unfortunately, musically, it wasn't really what I needed at the time. In New York, having already been here, I knew had that challenging environment that you kind of become addicted to once you're here. You know, especially if you're into creative music, and if you're into that kind of lifestyle where you don't like too much consistency, you know, like, if I can put it this way, having the job in Barcelona in an orchestra, it was wonderful, but the fact that it's like kind of a regular thing, it can kill your creative juices, you know. In New York, you're living in an environment with, you know, not just musicians, but everybody that comes here pretty much just come specifically for that one thing that they really want to do, you know, unless you're born here. But I have to be honest, most people that I know in New York moved here, you know, when their adult life. And so you have people that are incredibly, you know, dedicated and committed to whatever it is that they do, you know, photography or dance or even making money. You know, people are as passionate about making money as they are about like writing music. I mean, you know that, but you see it. And you know, and also the cultural, the diversity. I missed that too when I was in Europe, in Spain especially. I mean, in Paris you have that. Obviously there's a lot more integration there, or immigration as well. But Spain was not really, it was Spanish, you know. You had some North African influence, but it wasn't, you know, I really started to crave that sort of just the cultural diversity that we have in New York. And not even, you know, they say we have it in the United States, but you have it more in the bigger cities, you know. And especially as a musician, I was really craving being around African American people again, you know. And I realized as a jazz musician that's something I needed. I would just say, you know, and politically, it's also a place that I can live, because it is, I don't know, it's just, it's a tough time in the States right now, you know. Everything is kind of going crazy, but at least here I'm surrounded by people that kind of think the way I do, and that makes it possible. And it, like I said, if I had to leave, I don't know where I'd go, because music is pretty much the only thing I do and want to do. And I realized that at this stage of my life, New York is the only place I could probably do it, you know. Like, if I became, like, successful and famous and all, maybe I could go live somewhere and, you know, sort of use my name. Like, Steve Lacy lived most of his life in Europe or in Paris, you know. But I still need to have the guys around me, musicians around me, to kind of inspire me and keep me moving, if that makes sense.
We lost a jazz giant recently in Jackie McLean. I was just wondering what your thoughts were on this great musician.
Well, you know, I never worked with him. In fact, he, shortly after I left Ray Barretto's band, they went and played up with him in Hartford, where he was teaching, and I kind of regretted not having been on that. And I know a lot of guys here that study with him up there, and he's just, you know, it's like all these guys that are dying. It's just kind of reality setting in that these people that helped form the music are no longer here, you know. And they're invaluable, the ones that are still around, you know, like having met Paul Jeffries, like I said, a few weeks ago, and seeing Bob Cranshaw. You know, he works at the Musicians Union, he's very active in the whole thing there. You know, and you realize how valuable these people are to have around, and it's kind of tragic that they're going. They always seem to kind of all go at once too, like groups of them. You know, Ray Barretto, and then Jackie McLean, Don Elias. It just seems to kind of go off in groups, you know.
If you never had a life in music, what could you see yourself doing?
I'm kind of afraid to think of it, what my life would have become, you know, because as a result of being a musician, I've gotten the chance to travel quite a bit. And like my parents, you know, they never really did that, you know, and I probably would have ended up like them, somewhat provincial. I mean, they're not like ignorant people, but they are somewhat limited in their travels. They haven't seen the world much, and I feel lucky having been able to just travel the world and meet people and sort of broaden my horizon, so to speak. I don't know what I would do, Randy. I like cooking. I always thought about being a chef, or my father built houses. I thought about maybe getting into something like that, you know, but I think I'm lucky. I always knew music was going to be my vocation, you know. So I kind of, like I said, I'm afraid to think of what I'd have to do if I didn't have music as my career.
Thank you so much for dropping by today, Greg. It's been a lot of fun and a real pleasure.
Thank you, Randy. My pleasure as well.